Hello, and welcome to this episode of DebtWired. I'm Hossein Dabiri, Senior Editor and Head of Court Reporting EMEA at DebtWire. In early March, a restructuring plan proposed by a subsidiary of Germany-focused real estate business Aggregate Holdings SA was sanctioned by the English High Court. That headline, however, doesn't encapsulate all the drama that preceded the High Court's decision. You can, of course, read about what happened by going through DebtWire's extensive coverage of the court proceedings, but in a nutshell, the plan was vehemently opposed by three junior creditors. The initial contested sanction hearing, which was held over 4 days in February, included some of the most heated witness cross-examinations seen in the context of R26A restructuring plans. And the presiding judge, Mr. Justice Richards, refused to sanction the plan at the first attempt, finding that the court did not have jurisdiction to sanction it in its original form, as the original proposal was not a compromise or arrangement, as per the definition of those terms under the Companies Act 2006. The judge, however, then went on to set the stage for a new creditor meeting to be held at very short notice, from which the dissenting creditor clauses were excluded, followed by a further sanction hearings a few days later, in which this time a slightly amended version of the plan was sanctioned. Much of this had become necessary in light of the landmark decision of the English Court of Appeal overturning the contested Part 26A restructuring plan proposed by fellow German real estate company Adler Group. Taking stock of the Adler appeal judgment, the Aggregate Holdings case provided a valuable guidance for future restructuring plans. To discuss the most important takeaways from the case, which, by the way, to people closely involved in it is better known as Project First, we thought there would be no one better than the applicant company's legal advisors. Our guest today is David Manson, partner at DLA Piper, a veteran of London's restructuring landscape. David has led the DLA team that advised the company on its eventful debt restructuring. David, it's great to have you with us today.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
As I just mentioned, at the first sanction hearing, the company sought an amendment to the plan. Under the proposed amendment, subordinated creditors would receive a token payment in exchange for the discharge of the entirety of their claims when they had previously been set to walk away empty-handed. Could you start by explaining why the amendment to the plan became necessary following the Adler judgment?
Thanks, Hussein. This is a great place to start. Restructuring plans are a powerful addition to the restructuring toolkit. Their game-changing powers to affect cross-class cram-down and exclude out-of-the-money creditors significantly enhance the options, not only for UK companies, but for foreign companies as well. Looking at your question about the subordinated creditor consideration and amendments to the plan, let's set the scene about the first group and its creditor composition. Prior to completion of the restructuring, the total secured debt exceeded 1 billion euros. The group had three tranches of secured debt, ranking in the following order: the senior debt of approximately 775 million euros, the tier two debt of approximately 150 million euros, and the junior debt of approximately 95 million euros. The plan creditors are the holders of the senior debt, the tier two debt, and the junior debt. The tier two debt and the junior debt were wholly out of the money in the alternative scenario to the plan. On top of the sustained challenge to the first restructuring plan in both the UK and foreign courts, the plan was also novel in that between convening and sanction hearing, the debtor plan terms were stress tested. And that was in light of the guidance of the Court of Appeal overturning the Adler restructuring plan. Lord Justice Snowden's written ruling in Adler addressed, amongst other things, the treatment of out-of-the-money creditors. Albeit that the court's comments were non-binding, they're likely to be given significant weight. Under the Companies Act, the test requires that a plan must propose a compromise or arrangement between the company and its creditors or members, or any class of them. That is condition B, set out in section 901A3 of the Companies Act. The Court of Appeal in Adler expressed the view that a court does not have jurisdiction to sanction a plan which provides for a confiscation or expropriation of rights for no compensation, as that is not a compromise or arrangement. At the time, that the plan company commenced its plan way back in November 2023, at the convening hearing, the proposed plan offered no separate consideration pool for those subordinated creditors. There was plan precedent following Prezzo for providing no consideration to out-of-the-money creditors because they would be no worse off even if they were offered nothing under the plan. The modification proposal made by the plan company at sanction addressed the Adler guidance change head-on. First, a modification was proposed to fund a €150,000 fund to be allocated to senior Tier 2 creditors and a further fund of €50,000 for junior creditors, such funds only becoming available if the plan was successful. In this case, restarting from scratch would not have been an option, with the group already having reached the maturity dates of its loans and access to funding only via bridge funding arrangements put in place by supportive creditors for so long as the plan was viable. Mr. Justice Richards accepted that the plan company could rerun a plan meeting with its senior creditors only, and that the court could make an order dispensing with meetings of its subordinated creditors under Section 901(c)(4) of the Companies Act on the basis that none of those creditors has a genuine economic interest in the company. In this case, the court was satisfied that the consideration offered was substantial and appropriate.
Very interesting points, David. Thank you. But what approach did the court take at the initial sanction hearing? And how did it demonstrate flexibility in relation to the timeline for getting the plan over the finish line?
Flexibility is an art of creating ways out. And flexibility in a contested process is essential. So the super scheme gives debtors a number of new weapons in the restructuring armory. If a court is going to allow a debtor to use those powers to push for a restructuring via a cramdown, it's no surprise that restructuring plans can become hotly contested. We're seeing post-Adler, post-McDermott, and post-aggregate the continued refinement of the rules of the road for dealing with contested cases. And courts will increasingly need to use their discretion and case management powers to provide a fair and effective process. The court approach amounts to a firm but fair set of guidelines for companies. Don't leave it too late on the company side before you start. Similarly, don't expect the court to provide a completely expedited timetable where there is a challenge to the plan, which means debtors and supportive creditors will need to think about preserving optionality earlier and even the need for bridge financing, as was the case in the first restructuring. What is also clear is that challengers will have to take a more active role. Looking at the nuts and bolts of this as it unfolded for the first restructuring plan, the directions for an expedited hearing and exchange of evidence were agreed as part of the convening order, as it became clear at convening that the plan would be challenged on a number of grounds. In order to provide both time for the evidence and to ease pressure on the judge, the timetable was significantly elongated. The extension of time posed a significant issue, firstly from a liquidity standpoint, and secondly, as the contested nature of the proceedings had spilled over to other jurisdictions within the group, and which we were defending on multiple fronts. The court all recognized the need to consider certain aspects of the Adler Court of Appeal guidance as part of the sanction hearing, and so provided a further day of court time. The court in first was able to use its case management powers to find a balance between accommodating a fair and efficient process and the risks of undue delay on the group in accommodating a contested trial. In the sanction hearing, all findings of fact were determined by the court on which the facts were in dispute. Those findings of fact were critical in establishing that the plan company had discharged the burden of proof on the promotion of the restructuring plan. In order to avoid the plan stalling on a technical argument that there was no compromise or arrangement at the sanction hearing, the plan company invited the court to make orders that a further plan meeting of its senior creditors be held on short notice and that no other meetings be reconvened. That took place on the 1st of March, repeating the results of the previous meeting. The court granted an order under Section 901(c)(4) of the Companies Act only for the second time in plan history. That avoided what would have been a very value-destructive delay and supported the plan company to achieve a result which was overwhelmingly supported by in-the-money plan creditors. This novel first use of case management powers is likely to be a feature of more complex restructuring plan cases and ones where challenges are sustained and significant. It also allowed the debtor, which I'm sure we'll go on to discuss, to unlock the powerful exclusion powers to address out-of-the-money creditors.
As you said, this is the second successful application of Section 901(c)(4) of the Companies Act 2006 following Smile Telecoms. Tell us more, please, about the effect of that section, i.e. disenfranchisement of the out-of-the-money stakeholders.
I think this is an important theme to explore, so thanks for the question. The first case is only the second example in plan history of the use of the court's power to disenfranchise out-of-the-money junior creditors pursuant to 901(c)(4) and Section 901(f) of the Companies Act. And it is by the largest by value example of the usage of this creditor exclusion power. It is a fundamental principle, stepping back, in UK schemes, that creditors with no economic interest have no right to disrupt the process. The restructuring plan provisions formalize this for Part 26A plans. And while the provision has been little used, the right to exclude creditors is no less powerful than cross-class cramdown itself. Mr. Justice Richards concluded that the senior Tier 2 creditors and junior creditors were out of the money and had no genuine economic interest. This was based on valuation evidence presented exclusively by the plan company. In cases where valuation is clear or creditors' positions on valuations are well established, this is perhaps where the earliest battleground is going to be drawn. In Smile Telecom, the sanction judge said that those wishing to challenge evidence on the outcome in the relevant alternative must stop shouting from the spectator seats and step up to the plate, attend the hearing, and put forward their own valuation evidence. I think the first case provides another demonstration of the need to do that. The dissenting creditors here stepped up to the plate. They attended and raised their arguments at the sanction hearing, but they failed to swing. They didn't provide any independent expert evidence of their own on valuation to challenge the plan companies. The judge therefore accepted the plan company's evidence that the subordinated creditors would receive nothing in the relevant alternative. So the ability to win the valuation debate and use this Section 901(c)(4) power and its accompanying provisions should not be overlooked. It does provide an alternative to cross-class cramdown and highlights the criticality of valuation evidence and proper planning for these issues.
Staying with the out-of-the-money stakeholders for a moment, what weight did the court give to their views in its consideration of the fairness of the plan in relation to allocation of the restructuring surplus?
Great question. We tackled this head-on as part of the legal challenges. So let me try and unpack this. The Adler challenge and outcome, together with the two recent completed contested restructuring plan precedents of McDermott and the First Group, are important milestones in the continuing development of a world-leading cross-border restructuring regime in the UK. The cases are not revolution, and debtors should be confident that there is a very significant track record for the delivery of successful restructuring plans, which is, of course, something that should be weighed up in considering the benefits of one restructuring proposal or regime over another. A number of questions do still remain regarding the key issue of how the court should exercise its discretion to approve cross-class cramdown. Going beyond that, it's also clear that the court must assess whether there is a fair distribution of the benefits of the plan, the so-called restructuring surplus. In the first restructuring plan, the challenging creditors sought to argue that the plan involved an unfair distribution of that restructuring surplus. How that surplus is agreed to be shared by in-the-money creditors, who would in a failed plan be the fulcrum creditors, is increasingly key to ensuring sanction where cross-class cramdown is being used. Just to remind listeners, unlike Chapter 11, there's no absolute priority rule, and this means that treatment and retention of residual equity can depart from creditor and shareholder ranking in a relevant alternative. In the first plan, the complaint was that a greater proportion of the value in the group should have been allocated to the subordinated creditors, rather than being retained near creditors or other stakeholders, potentially in the nature of an equity interest in the group. And further, the complaint was that there was no justification for retention of equity or equity upside by the reference shareholder. Those arguments failed. However, a word to the wise. The 2023 cases and recent examples of plan failures, most notably in the context of HMRC challenge, show that exercising the right balance in allocating surplus is key, as this is an aspect which will be assessed as part of the court's determination of what is just and equitable when considering its discretion. And I think that fights over the restructuring surplus will be a future battleground in restructuring plans going forward.
The aggregate group's key assets are located in Germany, and the plan company, which is called Project Litzenberger Strasse Holdco SARL, is incorporated in Luxembourg. It had, however, moved its center of main interest, or COMI, to England, but there was still a dispute as to whether there had been an effective COMI shift or if the strategy amounted to bad forum shopping. What was the court's view on this?
The COMI shift was central to the success of the aggregate restructuring plan, as it provided the connection and basis to achieve the restructuring using the English courts. Some background facts are important to remind readers. The plan company is incorporated in Luxembourg. The plan company and group debts, the subject of the restructuring plan, were German law governed debt instruments. A foreign company must show that it has a sufficient connection with England. It has been held in many cases that a sufficient connection with England will be established where the company moves its COMI to England for the purposes of promulgating the scheme or plan. This is true, even if the relevant debt remains governed by a foreign law. So, by reason of the COMI shift alone, it is clear that the plan company has a sufficient connection with England. The judge in the first restructuring plan agreed with that analysis. Taking a step back for a moment, let's perhaps try and apply those learnings to a broader universe. A COMI shift provides an alternative basis for overseas companies seeking to create jurisdiction versus other mechanisms used in prior cases. For example, issuer substitution mechanisms or incorporation of co-obligors, the feasibility of which was left open in the recent ruling of the Court of Appeal in Adler. The establishment of COMI may, in addition, have a meaningful bearing on the likely recognition of a UK plan in another jurisdiction in which the plan company has assets. So, given that COMI shifts have been around the block for some time, it's perhaps surprising that such a focus was placed on the COMI shift. This was part of a concerted battle of the courts played out between Luxembourg and the UK for the battle of where the group should restructure or liquidate. The challengers argue that either the plan company shifted its COMI and therefore did not have a sufficient connection to the English jurisdiction, or if the plan company had shifted its COMI, that was an example of so-called bad forum shopping, and as such, the court should not sanction the plan. Both were quite difficult arguments to make, especially as the plan company had taken extensive steps to achieve the shift, certainly one of the most extensive COMI shifts I have seen and been involved in. And the courts have considered forum shopping conducted with a view to accessing a regime that has a restructuring and a rescue framework as generally being good forum shopping in other cases. So during the summer of 2023, senior creditors instructed the trustee and exercise certain voting rights to alter the board composition of the plan company and subsidiaries. The independently appointed managers undertook an analysis of the options available. Given the approaching debt maturities, they very rapidly sought to propose a comprehensive new money restructuring solution with its creditors, while at the same time undertaking an analysis as to the best restructuring process to implement that deal. And the group considered in this case that the UK regime had significant advantages, and therefore we set to work with the DLA team to shift the COMI of the plan company in order to pursue the plan. So in the case of the plan company, some of the key steps were, firstly, establishing a physical presence and lease of premises in England. In fact, the plan company moved to more extensive premises during the process, entering into a 36-month lease, demonstrating its need for a more long-term permanent presence in England. In addition, notifying creditors under debt documentation and otherwise that its business and management activities had been relocated to the UK, and very decisively, the appointment of a sole independent manager to the board of the plan company based in the UK, and the later hiring of three further UK-based full-time employees. So the plan company argued that the COMI shift was an example of good form shopping, that was to access a restructuring solution that was for the benefit of its creditors and would enable the completion of the development, without which the alternative would have been a value-destructive liquidation. In sanctioning the plan, the court found that the steps taken by Holdco in effecting its COMI shift were robust and sufficient to provide jurisdiction for the UK plan process, and such forum shopping had a proper, rational, commercial, and legal basis.
We have maybe time for just one more question, and that would be about the key takeaways from the case. In your view, how will the aggregate decision shape future restructuring plans?
The restructuring plan is a tool which has already begun to change the landscape. So looking at those lessons and playing it forward is a great idea. Capital structure complexities, the prevalence of covenant-lite deals, approaching the maturity wall, and of course the environment of a higher for longer rate environment are all going to feed through to the restructuring landscape in 2024 onwards with important implications. The existence of those things have a number of consequences. Companies can run closer to insolvency for longer with no real red light warnings or action points for creditors. And the weaponization of legal arguments around valuation, relevant alternative, and the restructuring surplus are perhaps just expected imports from the adoption of a new Chapter 11 style debtor in possession process. Let me leave you with six key takeaways where restructuring plans might be heading. First, expect more cross-border usage of restructuring plans and the twinning of those processes to achieve the widest possible recognition shield. The 2023 cases and those cases complete and on the stocks for 2024 suggest that there remains an appetite for forum shopping to the UK and for use of the restructuring plan. In the aggregate matter, we saw a jurisdictional battle play out between the jurisdiction of incorporation, where the challengers said a restructuring or liquidation should take place, and the UK. The widespread reach of English law finance documents and the UK court's continued recognition of the Gibbs rule means that overseas processes that seek to compromise English law obligations will not be recognized in the UK. As a result, a growing number of plans will certainly involve the use of a plan in parallel with an overseas process. Second, jurisdictional connections will come under the microscope and jurisdictional battles will become more frequent. The first case study shows simply that COMI shifting works. The issuer substitution and co-obligor mechanisms are alternatives which have been used on several occasions. The issuer substitution used in Adler wasn't contested, but the Court of Appeal said that its silence on that issue should not be taken as endorsement of the technique. foreign companies wishing to propose a Part 26A restructuring plan need to recognize the threat of litigation in jurisdictions outside of the United Kingdom, which may be used by challengers in an attempt to create a blot on the plan. However, the aggregate example shows that such actions can be successfully fought in parallel with the plan proceedings. Third, allocating the restructuring surplus requires a careful calculus. US Chapter 11, there's no absolute priority rule, so that higher ranking creditors do not need to be paid in full before lower ranking ones. Equally, retention of equity by existing shareholders and sponsors can be a powerful end goal to preserve optionality and long-term value accretion. Fourth, if you're out of the money, you need to get organized to avoid being out of luck. How to treat out-of-the-money creditors was a theme in 2023, and it will remain a theme in 2024. The first restructuring plan is another significant evolution in the use of restructuring plans, and my prediction is that exclusion rights under Section 901(c)(4) are equally powerful as cross-class cramdown under Section 901(g). Fifth, don't forget that the courts have teeth and they will use them. The courts have long warned that their discretionary power to sanction schemes and restructuring plans is more than just a rubber stamp. Courts will be prepared to use their case management powers, as we saw on First, to provide longer timetables, but also to bring the curtain down where key findings of fact have been made. The fact that we've also had a number of failed restructuring plans demonstrates that judges can and will use their powers and discretion. Playing fair with information become an increasing theme. And if a debtor is not making available information in a timely manner, expect the court to exercise its case management powers to allow a fair playing field. And my last takeaway, there will be more innovative uses of the restructuring plan as we do more in 2024, and companies look to survive till 2025 and beyond. Available data around default rates, maturity walls, and the increasing solvency filings points to an increasing trend towards a greater number of companies facing difficulties. Tackled early, those may be capable of rescue by some form of restructuring plan. Cross-class cramdown has been tested and will continue to be a powerful feature. Plans have in addition helped raise money, been used to compromise creditors, and provide a means to dilute existing equity. They've been used to amend and extend, and their reach has not simply been the domain for large cap debtors and complex cross-border cases, but has extended and will continue to extend to middle market opportunities. Similarly, expect the restructuring plan to be an essential part of the contingency planning kit as an alternative to an accelerated M&A process or administration. We can also potentially expect activity within the sponsor community looking to take advantage of flexible voting provisions and the powerful protective features that a plan can offer. And this is just a crystal ball prediction on my part, but my expectation is that there will be a structural candidate for a restructuring by way of cram up as the market evolves.
That would indeed be a fascinating development in the English restructuring landscape. This is a very dynamic and fast-moving area of law, so let's keep our eyes peeled and see if a cram-up happens anytime soon. Surely there's still lots to talk about on these topics, but I'm afraid we're running out of time. David, thank you so much for sharing your thoughtful insights with us. And our thanks go to our audience for listening to DebtWired. You can download more episodes of DebtWired podcasts on Apple or Spotify. Thank you.